We are joined live here in our studios by Joff Parrish and Maria Tomchick, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
And a very, very busy week at City Hall.
Yes, it was. This week, the City Council created a separate fund for the sweetened beverage tax. On Monday, they voted 7-1 to set up that dedicated fund for the collection of revenue from the sweetened beverage tax, isolating that money from the city's general fund budget. Mayor Jenny Durkin came out immediately afterwards and told the local news media that she would veto this bill, even though it passed by a veto-proof majority. Only council member Abel Pacheco, who is, I think, proving himself to be a really reliable ally of Mayor Jenny Durkin, voted against it. Deborah Juarez was absent. Now, when the council passed the sweetened beverage tax back in 2017, they recognized that the tax would fall more heavily on low-income people. And they wanted a way to ensure that the money would go for health and nutrition programs for low-income people. That was the promise that they made when they passed the sweetened beverage tax. But in last year's budget, Mayor Durkin used excess money collected through the sweetened beverage tax for a host of different programs in different departments so that she could then free up the money from those programs to use to expand programs that she wanted to expand, like the navigation team. Now, at that time, the city council chose not to change the budget, not to dig in and try to move money around in a lot of different programs. Instead, they passed a requirement that Mayor Durkin set up a dedicated fund for sweetened beverage tax revenue in 2019 to make sure that the money would go towards its intended purposes. And they told her to do it by at least the middle of this year so that they could have something in place before the annual budget review and revision process, which usually starts up in August or September. Well, Mayor Durkin had failed to do that, so Councilmember Mike O'Brien proposed this bill, his own bill, to create that dedicated fund. And that would start January 1st, 2020. So, of course, it's halfway through the two-year budget cycle. So that means that the programs that Mayor Durkin had allocated that $7 million in excess sweetened beverage tax money to will need to have their funding reallocated from the general fund, as they did in past years. And that's a change that the mayor can make with this year's budget revisions, but she doesn't want to. Instead, her human services department sent out letters a couple weeks ago to groups that are currently receiving money from the sweetened beverage tax revenue, telling them that their funds would be cut off in January, a really odious scare tactic to try and get them to pressure the city council to not pass this bill this week. Now, some of those human service providers saw through this scare tactic, and they turned up at Monday's city council hearing to urge the council to pass the bill, while others were taken in by Durkin's scare tactics, and they turned up at the meeting to urge the council not to pass the bill. So Monday's council meeting was really chaotic. In the meantime, there are food programs that could use that extra sweetened beverage tax money. For example, the Fresh Bucks program, which provides vouchers for low-income families to buy fruit and vegetables, has a waiting list of 3,500 people's names on it. Those are folks that are waiting for assistance to improve the nutrition for their for themselves and for their families. And for the mayor to play these games of taking sweetened beverage tax money, using it to fund other programs in the human services budget, playing those people off against folks who were hoping for the extra money for nutrition programs is really pretty sleazy, I think.
Yeah, the council was clearly rebuking Durkin and her budgetary practices on this. And, you know, Durkin's priorities very clearly through her budget process and really everything else, homelessness programs, et cetera, have turned out to be, give a short shift to people in low income in this city and not adequately funding those programs, et cetera. And this is the city council trying to rein those practices in a little bit. We'll see what happens when Durkin proposes her budget at the end of the year. The August-September process is the process of departments drawing up their budget proposals, and then Durkin's office pulls it together and gives a proposal to council, which holds public hearings in October, et cetera, and then they try and pass it generally by Thanksgiving. So it's going to be a chaotic process, and it's also what's behind the very clear effort by the business community to flip votes on city council with this year's election.
Yeah.
It was interesting, though, to see the city council, you know, almost unanimously, with the exception of Rob Johnson Jr.
The Rob Johnson replacement, Abel Pacheco, yeah. No, Abel Pacheco,
who's auditioning for a job with the city afterwards.
Yeah, it seems really clear to me that he's, you know, he gave up running in District 4 for this for a permanent place on the city council. And so now I think he's just looking for a job within city government.
All right, moving on, but sticking with Mayor Durkin came out with a proposal regarding funding for affordable housing.
Yeah, a couple of two or three proposals. These are not new, I want to point out, and they are proposals that have been ongoing. The first plan is to take advantage of a new bill passed in the state legislature to use a portion of the state's sales tax revenue that the city collects to fund the acquisition of land and construction of supportive housing for people exiting homelessness. The sales tax revenue is meant to be used to pay the debt service on 20-year bonds that the city would issue immediately to the tune of about $50 million to get construction of that housing underway immediately. Now, that sounds like that $50 million sounds like a lot of money, like it should pay for a lot, right?
No.
No, it doesn't. Permanent supportive housing with wraparound services is very, very expensive and would require ongoing funding, too, to keep it to run it. So that $50 million is expected to build and maintain about 200 units. And to house all the homeless in the city of Seattle, you'd need around 10,000 units.
I also want to point out that that's approximately a third of what the employee head tax would have raised each year under its original proposal.
Yeah. Now, the second plan is to renew the tax break for developers, known as the multifamily tax exemption, or the MFTE.
It worked so well.
Oh, yeah. The MFTE provides a tax break to developers who set aside 20 to 20% of the units in a new building for subsidized housing. And that's typically workforce housing, which is for people from 65 to 85% of median income, or up to about $64,600 per year. Or that translates to about getting paid $31 per hour. Now, median income in Seattle right now for the purposes of affordable housing is set at $76,000, although actual median income is over $82,000 in the city of Seattle right now. Now, the top rent for a studio in the subsidized housing program is in the MFTE program is $1,520. For a one-bedroom, it's $1,737. And for a two-bedroom, it's $2,198 per month. And then utilities are added on top of that. So that's essentially market rate, right? And that's what the MFTE defines as affordable housing. Now, I want to just point out, too, that a minimum wage of $16 per hour if you work at a large employer in the city of Seattle means that you'd make $33,280 per year, or about 44% of median income. If you work for a small employer in the city of Seattle who also gives you health care benefits but pays you a minimum wage of $12 per hour, you'd make $24,960, or 33% of median income. So one-third of median income. That's the range where we have to be looking in terms of affordable housing for working people. And for people who work part-time, those are for people who work full-time, for people who work part-time or who are disabled or who are elderly and on fixed incomes or who cannot work, it's even harder to make a go of it. Those are the folks who are really end up on the street as homeless people in the city of Seattle because they can't afford the rent. So the units, in order to qualify for the program, have to stay in the program for 12 years with the idea that once the 12 years is up, the building will be old enough that all of the units will be affordable without the subsidy. But that has not been the case in the city of Seattle over the past two decades. So that has people questioning, okay, you've got these units that are just below market rate that are only helping, you know, a few people, and yet after 12 years, then they can jack the rents up, which is essentially what's been happening. With this renewal, Durkin is seeking to change that, but only somewhat. She's proposing a cap of 4.5% rent increase per year on subsidized units in the program versus double-digit increases as they've had in recent years, which is why those rents are so high. But that's likely to only include new units built starting in 2020, not the 4,500 currently existing units in the program. And by allowing the new units to start out at a ridiculously high rate, it's not going to help a whole lot if you cap the increases to just 4.5%.
And I want to point out that the city's affordability programs are rife with these sort of definitional games. Mm-hmm. Where they're defining affordability at a ridiculous rate, they're putting stipulations on how the money can be used that really doesn't help renters. You really have to look at the specifics of these programs to understand why they're not working.
Yeah, and in the meantime, we're losing public housing with the Seattle Housing Authority selling off large chunks of land to build this type of workforce housing that's too expensive for people who really need it. And the folks who used to be served by public housing, folks who are at 60% or below median income, those folks are getting kicked out on the street a lot of the time.
Or in the case of Yesler Terrace, corporate suites.
Yeah, yeah. Now, yeah, exactly. There are chunks of Yesler Terrace that are being sold off to build commercial real estate.
Over 50%, actually.
Yeah, and that's a crime. I think that is an absolute crime. Now, the third plan that the mayor announced this week was the sale of the Mercer Mega Block. That's a large plot of city-owned land on Mercer Street between 9th Avenue North on the west and Dexter Avenue North on the east. Activists have been urging the city to use that huge plot of land for affordable housing. Instead, the city will be selling that land to a private developer, probably for around $100 million.
It's immediately adjacent to Amazon's campus.
Yeah, and it's got great views of Lake Union. Now, part of that money will be used to pay off a big debt of over $30 million that the city has already borrowed against the future proceeds of this sale, leaving the rest maybe as much as, $50 million, maybe a little more, to be used for affordable housing. Now, the city could also put conditions on the sale of that land, requiring that the developer build affordable housing units on site or on a different site in South Lake Union. A goal of 175 affordable units has been discussed. Mayor Durkin says that she'll have a sales offer for the city council to review sometime in the next 2 weeks. But again, 175 units is a real drop in the bucket of what's needed. And we've seen that $50 million doesn't pay for a whole lot of affordable housing. Durkin has not yet provided any details about how that money from the sale will be used for various affordable housing programs, so we just don't know yet what is entailed. We do know, though, that the sale of that property means it's not going to be used entirely for affordable housing.
Not going to be used for nutrition programs either.
Yeah. And again, in the end, we need a mayor and a city council who are willing to convert and repurpose existing housing to make it affordable enough to house the homeless and prevent more low-income folks from becoming homeless in Seattle. Because we just don't have the money to build enough to house 10,000 people.
And it's right across the street on Mercer from a bunch of the UW research properties. So I'm willing to bet money that a chunk of that is going to go towards similar buildings.
Yeah, it's going to probably go towards a company that is doing some kind of scientific research or technical.
Biotech.
Yeah. Biotech, yeah.
Yeah. And for instance, money's on Alexandria Real Estate.
Yes. Yeah, so
what
yeah.
can go wrong?
So that raises the question of how the heck are they going to fit affordable housing units in a high-tech biotech facility?
They won't.
Yeah.
Unless it's primates.
If you want to call primate cages
yeah.
affordable housing, I guess.
All right. Anything else on that?
No.
All right. Let's
hey,
let's
it works stick for, with it works for immigrant kids.
Let's stick with Mayor Durkin for 300.
for $200 million in unfunded money.
Yeah. Now, I just talked about how the city's already borrowed over $30 million against the Mercer Mega Block sale. Mayor Durkin is asking the city council for $9 million in funding for the First Avenue streetcar, but she wants the council to borrow that $9 million against the sale of the Mercer Mega Block.
And that's just to continue it for a year.
Yeah, it's the design to fund.
How the actual streetcar link is going to be built, it's entirely unfunded at this point.
Now, Durkin had previously frozen work on the streetcar when the Seattle Department of Transportation told her the streetcar was $65 million over budget at minimum. It will be projected to cost a total of $286 million, far higher than the first two streetcar lines put together.
And climbing.
Yeah, and it will likely be used mostly by tourists, I should point out, too.
And that's also a much shorter link than the first two lines.
Yeah, now in January, Durkin unfroze the project, but has done little to advance it. And I think that's because she sees the current city council, is less likely to do what she wants, but she has great expectations for this year's council elections to bring in a more business-friendly city council. But the city is at risk of losing the $75 million that the federal government has allocated for the First Avenue streetcar if construction isn't well underway by September of next year. Only $50 million of that $75 million has been allocated so far, and that could be withdrawn if progress is not made soon. So SDOT, or the Seattle Department of Transportation, has also, has released ridership numbers for the two existing streetcar lines, which would be linked up by the First Avenue streetcar. The First Hill streetcar, which runs from Broadway and Capitol Hill to the Central District and the International District, had 1.2 million riders in 2018, which is 100,000 riders short of SDOT's goal of 1.3 million riders on that line. And that's the successful line. The South Lake Union trolley had only 500,000 riders in 2018, a really dismal record, given that that's just a little more than half of the projected ridership of 912,000 that SDOT was reaching for the South Lake Union trolley.
And that line has consistently underperformed in terms of ridership.
Yes, it has, and been a huge draw, been maybe not huge comparative when you compare it to other transportation projects, but a big, big draw on the city budget. Now, that represents a fall of 4% in ridership totals on the South Lake Union line. And of course, that makes sense, because if you walk the length of the South Lake Union line, you very quickly realize that the South Lake Union trolley doesn't really take people anywhere that you can't already walk, and walk faster sometimes than the trolley actually runs. In addition, the South Lake Union trolley ran on schedule only 39% of the time last year. Again, really dismal record for what the city calls a commuter option.
And for all of these streetcar lines, the construction costs and operating costs are exponentially higher than bus lines.
Yeah.
Because it's fixed rail. And so primarily it's about driving up real estate values. It's not about ridership. That's secondary.
It's very,
as with many Seattle transportation projects.
It's very clear now that the South Lake Union trolley really is the Paul Allen Memorial Trophy train. It's not really a commuter option. And the First Hill line, although it has a lot of riders now, is still underperforming. So I find that kind of interesting that Mayor Durkin, even though she wanted to be sort of tough, sort of show herself as somebody who's tough and physically responsible by freezing the First Avenue streetcar, I think it's probably was a political calculation that she needed a more sympathetic city council in place before she could steam ahead with building a big real estate boondoggle like that.
Well, speaking of her great expectations for a potential new city council coming in.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about election news.
She came out this week and spoke not so glowingly about a couple of the candidates that were running.
Well, particularly Tammy Morales, by red-baiting her, calling her a socialist. And Tammy Morales has said multiple times that she is not a socialist, which I find kind of interesting, even though many of her policies are. And I don't see what the problem is. I mean, if you're a socialist, I have no issue with that. But apparently red baiting still is a problem here in the city of Seattle, and it can be a problem if you're in the second district, apparently.
Apparently, it's, yeah, in the toolkit if you're trying to.
Yeah.
Yeah, because there are two actual socialists running for city council this year.
There are.
One of whom's an incumbent, and neither of them is working particularly closely with the Morales campaign.
No. I just want to remind people, too, don't forget to mark your ballots and mail them in well ahead of August 6th so that they will be recorded as being received on time.
Yes.
The King County Elections is recommending you mail them on the Friday before August 6th. And I would encourage people to mail them this week. Now, Washington State is changing over to a new election system this year. There's been some setbacks. In King County, there was a problem with some addresses transferring correctly from the old system to the new one. So if you have not received your ballot yet, you can call King County Elections, and I would urge you to do that right away. King County, the number for King County Elections is 206-296-8683, and tell them you haven't received your ballot and give them, you know, the pertinent details, your name and address, et cetera. You can register online until July 29th at www.vote.wa.gov.
That's Monday. It's the 29th.
Yes, yes, that's vote.wa.gov. But new this year is same-day voter registration.
Yes.
With the new system. People can register to vote until 8 p.m. on Election Day, August 6th, if they do it in person. There are 5 in-person voting centers in King County. The easiest one for Seattle residents is at the King County Administration Building downtown at 500 4th Avenue, room 440. And that's between Jefferson and James Street off of 4th Avenue downtown. So if you don't make the Monday's deadline to register online, you can go downtown to the King County Administration Building between Jefferson and James Street off of 4th Avenue, room 440. And register to vote in person right up to the day of the election.
Yes.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about PAC advertising in these races, particularly the city council races. CASE, which is the Seattle Chamber of Commerce PAC, has done advertising on various blogs around town, like the West Seattle blog in support of Phil Tavel against Lisa Herbold in District 1, and Capitol Hill blog for Egan O'Ryan in District 3 against Shama Sawant. Now, they've also purchased Facebook and Twitter ads for Phil Tavel, and they also have done a lot of phone calling and texting for their preferred candidates in District 1, 2, and 3. That's Phil Tavel, Mark Solomon, and Egan O'Ryan.
Yeah, I got a Facebook ad for Egan O'Ryan also that was paid for by CASE.
Yes. Rich People for Seattle, that's the group started by, or People for Seattle, which I call Rich People for Seattle, which the group that started by former conservative city council member Tim Burgess, has sent out mailers opposing Lisa Herbold, Tammy Morales, Shama Sawant, Zachary DeWolf, and Emily Myers, proving that I think an good alternative name for their group would be Evil Rich People for Seattle. Now, they've also sent out non-candidate specific emails on behalf of Phil Tavel in District 1, Mark Solomon in District 2, Egan O'Ryan in District 3, Alex Peterson in District 4, and Deborah Juarez in District 5, their preferred candidates in those races. There's a third group, Moms for Seattle. They've spent a lot of money on mailers, but they've also bought Facebook ads to the tune of $12,000 spent for each of 4 candidates. Pat Murakami in District 3, Alex Peterson in District 4, Heidi Wills in District 6, and Michael George, not George Michael, but Michael George in District 7.
No, all of the names that we've mentioned so far are people you should not vote for.
Yes, these are not people you should vote for. Moms for Seattle is kind of an interesting group because they came out of nowhere, and for a long time nobody really knew who they were. I did a little research into them this week, and it's clear that they're a group of wealthy homeowners who are aligned with the NIMBY neighborhood folks who want to criminalize homelessness. They were they announced their formation on Save Our Seattle, and they've gotten quite a bit of support from them. One of their biggest contributors and organizers is Janine Navone. She was one of their 4 original donors and has also arranged meetings for the group and donated meeting space to the group. So I think it's really her pet project. She's the wife of hedge fund manager Constantino Dino Christofilis. He's kind of an interesting guy, but also kind of secretive. So it is hard to find information on them. But it's very clear that they're sort of right wing, wealthy, and they're based on Capitol Hill. And I think one of the reasons that they jumped into funding candidates in the city council race is because they really, really, really hate Shama Sawant. Now, the only other major PAC advertising in the local elections are from labor groups. Unite Here Local 8 is spending about $148,000 on TV and online ads to support one candidate. That's Andrew Lewis in District 7. We actually have endorsed him. And Working People for an Affordable Seattle has spent about $13,600 on digital ads for Emily Myers in District 4, another darling of the labor movement. That group has taken two large contributions of $10,000 each from the United Food and Commercial Workers 21 and SEIU 775, the Home Health Care Workers Committee. So those are the only other big sources of PAC money in the race. The main sources are these conservative pro-business groups, CASE, which is connected to the Seattle Chamber of Commerce, Rich People for Seattle, and Moms for Seattle.
And CASE has raised well over $1 million now.
Well, they've raised, from what I can tell, just under $1 million. But my guess is this week they're going to top that.
I talked to a local campaign manager this week, and he said it was over $1 million now.
Okay, yeah. I was looking at their filings, but, you know, that's always a little bit of a delay between today and when their last filing was.
Well, and they, looking at filings, seems that different groups can wait weeks or months
yeah.
between.
So I'll just summarize really quickly for people who I was just talking about the different candidates in the city council races. The candidates that we think are the most progressive are Lisa Herbold in District 1, Tammy Morales in District 2, Job also likes Chris Perguero in District 2, but I think people should unite behind Tammy Morales. District 3, Shama Sawant. District 4, Sean Scott and or Emily Myers. District 5, John Lombard. District 6, I like John Lisbon. Job likes Kara Cariello.
Yeah, I don't really strongly like anybody in that race.
Yeah. Yeah, and District 7, Andrew Lewis.
Yeah, and I had my recommendations up on Facebook, and Maria has
and
a,
I do
a link,
too.
Yeah,
to I have city council members, and Job has his recommendations for all the races, including school board and port commission.
Yep. And the two propositions.
Yes, and the two propositions, which we both think the progressive stance is to vote yes on those.
Yes.
All right, moving on. Developments over this last week regarding homelessness here in Seattle.
Yeah, HSD, which is the department of the city that is in charge of homelessness policy, has been kind of in free fall for the last few months. It has an interim director, Jason Johnson, who's nomination to become permanent director was withdrawn by Mayor Durkin after a lot of opposition by rank-and-file HSD members. Last week on Friday, the sweep czar, the person in charge of homeless sweeps, which of course have been dramatically increased under Mayor Durkin, abruptly resigned. And it turns out, according to an article in Real Change this week, that was over a May 15th incident in which REACH, which is one of the nonprofits that does advance work in these camps to try and connect people with social services, abruptly severed.
They're the main nonprofit that's
yes.
been working outreach
yes.
for the navigation
they,
teams.
They abruptly severed relations and a working relationship with the navigation teams. And what happened was they went into one of these camps and found a dead body. And that camp was scheduled to be swept the following day. They asked the city for a delay in that sweep because people were traumatized by the death. They knew this person. And, being swept, obviously, and losing your home re-traumatizes people. And the city refused. They went ahead with the sweep, which is staggeringly inhumane, as far as I can tell. And apparently there was some internal blowback to that, and that was what led to St. Louis's resignation. No indication where St. Louis is going in terms of a future job or who will replace St. Louis. And it really underscores, number one, how hostile to the homeless the city's official homeless helping policies are. Number two, who's going to replace REACH now that REACH is no longer doing that work?
Well, the navigation team expanded to include at least two in-house outreach people who, ostensibly, I think, to replace Reach, because now the city can't get a third-party nonprofit to do that work because all of the other nonprofits don't want to do work that's essentially useless because the city is not allowing the 72-hour notice and not giving them time to do their actual job.
Yeah, the city has discovered that if it declares an encampment a public health hazard, it can waive the requirement for advance notice and really waive the requirement for offering services to the people in that mm-hmm. camp. And that's what it's doing in the majority of its suites.
Yeah,
now.
And that's essentially what the leaders of Reach were saying. They were saying, you know, we just can't do our jobs. We're given 30 minutes notice to go there to try to talk to people in those few minutes while they're packing up and offer them services is not working. And they don't trust us because we show up when the cops do and they assume we're the same as the police and they don't want to talk to us.
And that kind of outreach is based on trust and based on building relationships. Yeah. And you can't build a relationship in 30 minutes.
No.
City Council in the session before they talked about the tax, the soda tax, and had the pushback against Durkin's office, had some pretty heated questions for the head of HSD regarding the different sweeps and stuff. And that was, I encourage people to watch that if they haven't seen it.
Yeah, including a flyer that has been circulating around, apparently not. It says on it, see a tent, report a tent, and it gives information on how to report homeless in tent encampments to the city for sweeps through an app that the city has released for residents to report nuisances to the city. Now
that was not put out by the city.
It was not put out by the city, but Teresa Mosqueda quizzed the HSD representatives at that meeting. She wanted to know, you know, how many complaints have you been getting related to this flyer? You know, who's been circulating this? You know, do you guys agree with this? Are a lot of the complaints that you get through this app related to homeless encampments, et cetera, et cetera? She really quizzed them pretty heavily on that.
And it turns out the vast majority of complaints that they were getting were spam. Including a lot of complaints about the REI flagship store because it has so many tents.
Yeah, actually, after some activists posted that flyer on Facebook and said, "See what's happening in our city," a whole bunch of people started
Twitter as
using
well.
Using the app to do these false reports. Yes, I saw a tent. It was in REI, and they'd give the address for REI.
First, there was a couple different versions, revisions of that flyer.
Right.
That were posted online and circulated.
Yes.
So,
tent, leave them the F alone.
Yeah, exactly. And apparently the push to report REI was a Twitter phenomenon.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was totally a social media.
It was a social media phenomenon. Thing. Yeah.
So.
All
yeah,
right.
The RI reporting.
Yeah,
made
some
my week.
Apparently some right wing NIMBY taking it into their own hands to come up with a flyer, but it's backfired on them.
Yes, or the Ari Hoffman campaign.
Yeah,
one or the other.
Possibly.
All right. Anything else on that?
No.
Let's move on.
The status of affirmative action law.
Yeah. The state legislature passed an affirmative action law by initiative. I-1000 was submitted to the legislature this past spring with a record number of signatures, and the state legislature had a choice of either passing it into law or putting it on the November ballot. They passed it into law, and now opponents of affirmative action have apparently submitted enough signatures to qualify referendum 88 for the November ballot. So it will be on the ballot this November anyway, and it's likely to be a very contentious ballot item. The state's new affirmative action law specifically says that quotas are not available, but that the state and local governments are allowed to use things like ethnicity and being part of a disadvantaged class as part of the hiring criteria. So this is going to be on the November ballot, and we'll see how it plays out.
All right. Moving on to national, it appears the Supreme Court has weighed in on funding for the wall.
Yes, by a 5-4 margin. This is the exact 5-4 that you would expect. And I want to point out once again that if Merrick Garland were on the Supreme Court, it would likely be reversed. The Supreme Court reversed lower court rulings and okayed Donald Trump's reallocation of military money to the border wall, even though Congress has specifically opposed that allocation.
They lifted a stay, yes, that allows the Trump administration to begin work by transferring funds from the Pentagon to the border wall while the cases play out in the lower courts.
Yeah. And among other things that will be affected by the military, it's not like these big weapons projects are being losing their funding. It's things like 23,000 military families getting cuts to their food stamp allocations, things that are basically military human services, which tells you where Trump's priorities are.
Yeah, just how much he loves the troops.
Yeah, or not.
All right, and also this week, Robert Mueller was in Congress.
Yeah, and I would encourage people to go online and seek out the highlights to that, not the whole 7 hours, because you will fall asleep. But there were some gems buried in that 7 hours, some of which were covered by mainstream media and some of which were not. One of the things we learned from Robert Mueller, aside from his emphasis, his right correct emphasis, I think, on the fact that Russia not only interfered in the 2016 election, but is doing so again actively now for the 2020 election, and that is likely to only get worse as the 2020 election approaches. And the federal government, of course, has done nothing to prevent that, because why would they? The federal government is an extension of Donald Trump at this point. He also, among other things, said under oath that Donald Trump, in his written answers to questions from the special counsel, because, of course, they could not agree on an in-person interview because Trump's lawyers were afraid that he couldn't stop himself from lying. Apparently, he couldn't stop himself from lying in writing either. He didn't directly answer most of the germane questions that Mueller put to him, this according to Mueller. But Mueller also characterized the answers that he did give as at odds with other evidence that Mueller had and his team had collected. So Trump's lawyers failed. They failed in preventing Trump from lying even to written questions, even though he was not answering most of those questions directly. He still lied because he can't help himself.
Yeah.
We also found out a number of details about, and I want to point out also that several of the other people who have been indicted and in some cases sentenced under cases from the special counsel did so for lying under oath. And Trump, of course, was under oath when he submitted those written questions. So this is yet another example of a crime that Trump has committed. Were he any other person, he would likely be indicted for. We also found out that a number of Trump's surrogates had financial ties to the former Soviet Union or Russia. Mueller went into some detail on that, even though he said his team did not follow the money, by and large. But in some of the cases of people that were prosecuted, such as Paul Manafort, they did follow the money. And that led to some pretty unsavory places. And really, the number of people in Trump's orbit who owed money to oligarchs and or the Russian federal government is quite remarkable, and raises the question about Trump's taxes once again, and what Trump owes to whom, and why he's been so apologetically obsequiously friendly to Vladimir Putin, because there has been no logical explanation for that. And the explanation, at least according to Mueller, is likely financial. So those things were buried in Mueller's testimony, along with many other things, and I would encourage people to go find that out.
All right. Speaking of the president and future potential presidents.
Presidential candidates, yeah. Now, I want to do a look at the Democratic presidential candidates, similar to kind of what I did with the city council candidates this year. But rather than going candidate by candidate, I wanted to look at issue by issue.
Yeah, and we've got debates coming up this week.
Yeah,
too.
And just to look at, say, the top five or six candidates, because looking at all 25 would take forever, and it'd be way more work than really is necessary.
And there won't be 25 in another couple weeks.
Yeah, in another couple months, I think it'll be cut way down. Yeah, now,
because the third debate has much stricter criteria.
It does.
And a lot of people are not going to qualify for it.
It does. Now, the Democratic Party has made healthcare reform a major piece of its platform this year. Progressives from the left are calling for a single-payer healthcare system, while conservative pro-business Democrats want to make small tweaks to Obamacare, in other words, the Affordable Care Act. So I wanted to look at the policies of the top six candidates and how they relate to healthcare. And I'm looking at the top six who are averaging more than 2% support in the polls. That's how I determined my cutoff. So number one is Joe Biden. His plan to protect and build on the Affordable Care Act, in addition to allowing private insurance to continue offering plans on the federal and state marketplaces, he would set up a public option for people not covered through their employers, similar to Medicare, but not a Medicare expansion. You would still have to pay premiums for the public option. He would increase a tax credit to make insurance premiums more affordable than they are now, so that you don't have to pay more than 8.5% of your income on insurance. Of course, for some folks, that's still going to be way too much. In Republican states that didn't expand Medicaid to the poor, Biden would let folks who qualify for Medicaid get the public option insurance for free, with automatic enrollment for people who make below 138% of the poverty level. For states that have already expanded Medicaid, they could move their residents to the public option, but they would still have to pay their share of the cost of covering those folks.
Now, I also want to point out that 138% of the federal poverty level is really low.
It is really low, yeah. Now, I foresee that this unequal treatment between the states by expanding the program for free to folks in, say, Texas, but not to people in Washington state, could provoke further lawsuits. And then I have to say it's all conditional on the Republican-led lawsuits that have almost completely overturned the Affordable Care Act at this point. Biden says that he will fight these lawsuits, but he gives no details on how he would reverse recent court decisions against the Affordable Care Act, ones that could eventually completely gut the program.
And it's also conditional on the Democrats winning the Senate, because yeah. None of these proposals for
would
none of these candidates are going to pass with McConnell in charge of the Senate.
Yeah. Now, in addition, I don't see any means to control overall health care and prescription drug costs in Joe Biden's plan. So now Bernie Sanders, he's number two in the polls at this point. His proposal, you know, and if you look at Biden's is pretty conservative for most of the Democrats. Bernie Sanders is the far left side. He proposes Medicare for all, a single payer system. He would expand Medicare over a four-year period to cover all U.S. residents. That's important, not just U.S. citizens, but U.S. residents. And expand treatment to include prescription drugs, mental health, dental coverage, vision care, hearing aids, long-term care, and substance abuse treatment. He would eliminate co-payments and deductibles. Private insurance is only allowed for services not covered by Medicare, so most private insurance would go away. Veterans will still get their treatment through the VA, and Native Americans through the Indian Health Service. Now, the biggest objection that most people have, because this all sounds really pretty good, right, is the cost. How do you pay for it? Sanders has put forward a number of options, and I mean really a dozen or more options on how to pay for it. It's not something he can go into in a 60-second debate answer to a debate question. But things like a 7.5% income-based premium paid by your employers, or a 4% income-based premium paid per household, or savings from a reduction in healthcare costs under a single-payer plan, which could be up to $4.2 trillion over 10 years, because his plan is the best for controlling overall healthcare and prescription drug costs. A single-payer can very, very easily negotiate down healthcare prices, whereas a market that has many, many different insurance companies and other payers, it's much more difficult.
Yes, and Medicare is specifically banned from negotiating.
From doing
prices.
That. Yeah. And many people have talked, particularly in the Democratic Party, about lifting that ban. He's also proposed increasing income taxes on the wealthy, which is actually very popular. As many as 70% of independent voters support increasing taxes on the wealthy. Adding, for example, marginal tax rates of 40% for people who make between $250,000 to $500,000 per year, a 45% marginal tax rate for people who make between $500,000 to $2 million per year, a 50% marginal tax rate for people who make between $2 and $10 million per year, and a top rate of 52% for people who make more than $10 million per year. Again, these marginal tax rates are less than in many other developed nations. This could raise about $1.8 trillion over the next decade. He's also talked about tax on capital gains, taxing capital gains and dividends at the same rate as salary and wages. He's talked about capping the tax deduction for rich people, tax deductions for rich people at 28% of income. He's talked about making the estate tax progressive so that wealthier estates would pay more money, and closing the loopholes that allow most very wealthy estates to avoid paying the tax altogether. He's also talked about levying a wealth tax on the top 0.1% of individuals to raise about $1.3 trillion over 10 years, and on and on. There are just many, many, many ways that you could raise money for this. Of course, as Job said before, you would have to have a Democratic control of both the House and the Senate in order to do that.
And probably 60 votes in the Senate to avoid filibusters.
Yeah.
Or an abolition of the filibuster, which is its own problem.
Yeah, one thing that Bernie Sanders doesn't mention is a tax that Republicans have often derided and said would be necessary to pay for an expansion of Medicare, which is raising the Medicare tax rate on wages and salaries. That's not something that Sanders has even proposed. Now, some very good aspects of this plan is, of course, everyone's covered. So hospitals and doctors don't have to jack up the cost of overall care for the insured in order to pay for uninsured people who can't afford to pay. That's the major method of cost control in this plan, but not one to be sneezed at, because that could very well stabilize our healthcare system. Another very good aspect of Sanders' plan is that it's legal. Expanding Medicare would more easily survive court challenges since Medicare has been constitutional for 44 years, covering all elderly folks and disabled people. So you wouldn't run into the same kind of constitutional challenges that the Affordable Care Act
has. Almost as long as Roe v. Wade has been constitutional.
Yeah, uh-huh. A single-payer government plan can, as I said, more easily negotiate down prices for healthcare services and prescription drugs. And of course, the cons, the objections to the plan are also pretty obvious. Someone, if not everyone, will need to pay more in taxes. But middle income and poor folks would see their overall tax increase be a lot less than what they were formerly paying for co-payments, deductibles, and premiums. Although currently most Americans get their insurance through their employer, most of those folks don't have any idea how much their premiums actually cost, because it's a hidden part of their compensation that they don't see. So many Americans already think that their health insurance is free when it's not. And so they only have co-payments and deductibles that they have to worry about if they get sick and if they need to use their insurance. So that's why so many people love their employer-provided plans, is because they think it's free. It's not. It's part of your compensation that you just don't see. So if we had a government-provided health care, then folks might have higher wages, maybe. Higher take-home pay if they know to negotiate for it. So another objection is that everyone who makes boatloads of money from the health insurance industry to the drug companies to big hospitals and healthcare chains are going to fight this. Because when you cut out the middleman, those folks will need to get a job somewhere else, or they will lose a significant portion of their income. The government could hire a large proportion of those people, but not all of them. So, and of course, a lot of shareholders in those companies are not going to like it. Now, the third candidate The third most popular candidate in the race is Elizabeth Warren, and she has no specific plan for healthcare on her website, and I haven't seen her release one. But she did raise her hand at the last Democratic debates to abolish private insurance in favor of a government-run plan, and she later spoke in favor of Medicare for all. But again, we don't know what her version would look like and if it would differ at all from Bernie Sanders' version. Kamala Harris, she's the fourth most popular candidate in the race. Her website says that she supports Medicare for all that includes dental care and vision services and would eliminate premiums and out-of-pocket costs. But her website doesn't go into a lot of details about what other services would be included, because there's a lot of other services included in the Sanders plan that I don't see listed on Harris's website, nor does she talk about possibilities for how to pay for an expansion of Medicare, as Bernie Sanders does. During last month's debate, Harris raised her hand along with Bernie Sanders when asked who among the candidates would abolish private health insurance in favor of a government plan. But then the next day, she immediately walked that back to say that she misunderstood the question. She would allow private insurance for supplemental coverage, services not provided under her version of Medicare for all. But again, we don't know yet what she means by those supplemental services. Does she mean mental health care, long-term care, prescription drugs, substance abuse treatment? All those things are included under the Sanders plan, but not on her plan on her website. So maybe she just hasn't thought it through yet, or maybe she just doesn't want to commit to specifics. Very common issue with candidates. Now it leaves me with the fifth candidate. That's Pete Buttigieg. He's kind of interesting. He's for a plan called Medicare for All Who Want It. His plan looks a lot like Joe Biden's plan, a public option to be sold on the healthcare exchanges that people can buy into. He would not abolish private insurance or employer-provided insurance coverage. Instead, he wants the public option to compete with private insurance plans and employer-provided plans. So you could choose, he would open it up so that you could choose between your employer plan or the public option, though I think most people wouldn't want to leave their employer plan because for them, their employer-provided insurance is free in their minds, right? Now, or even when they pay a portion of their employer-provided insurance, they're still only paying a portion, so it would be cheaper. So I don't think that his public option could compete well with employer-provided plans, and I don't think that there would be a big shift there. Now, his plan doesn't include the increase in tax credits that the Biden plan does to limit health insurance premiums to a set percentage of income for middle-class and poor folks. So even though they would have this public option plan and it would be cheaper than private insurance, they still wouldn't be able to afford it. It also doesn't expand Medicaid to Republican states or subsidize 100% of the public option plan costs for people who are at or below poverty level in those states. So again, millions, that's, you know, it has all the same downsides as Biden's plan, particularly the fact that the Affordable Care Act is at the point of being gutted in the courts, except that Buttigieg's plan is potentially worse in that it leaves millions of very poor people still without coverage. And then finally, the sixth candidate, the only other one that's above 2% in the polls, is Beto O'Rourke. He's a supporter of Medicare for All. He was a supporter of Medicare for All, but he's not anymore. He supports Medicare for America, a hybrid expansion of Medicare to all uninsured people, which still allows businesses to offer insurance coverage for employees. Businesses would opt to buy into Medicare. The price for that would be set at 8% of their annual payroll. Employees would also be able to choose between their employer-provided insurance or Medicare. Insurance companies would not be allowed to sell policies on the open market to individuals that would duplicate what Medicare covers. People who make less than 200% of the poverty level would pay no premiums for Medicare coverage, but everyone above that level would pay premiums with a cap at 9.69% of their income. So you're getting an idea. It's you know, yet another variety of how you could do a public option, you know, sort of expand Medicare, but not expand Medicare. The upsides to this are clear. I mean, people can keep their employer-sponsored insurance if they want to. The healthcare exchanges wouldn't be needed, so the Affordable Care Act can be repealed or overturned in court. But the downsides are also really clear to O'Rourke's plan. There are no cost controls in the plan. O'Rourke claims that businesses will eventually abandon private insurance and want to buy into Medicare, but many businesses have been cost-sharing their premiums with their employees. So I'm not sure that businesses will find that Medicare buy-in cheaper than paying, say, 50% of private insurance.
I'm thinking 8% of payroll is not going to be adequate for covering health.
Yeah, I'm thinking that's not adequate either. And I'm also not sure that the premiums that uninsured people will pay will cover the full cost of the Medicare expansion, along with those few employers that do decide to buy into it. No one is quite sure how the in-network and out-of-network provider system will work with Medicare versus the employer-provided plans. And no one really knows how co-payments and deductibles would work under the O'Rourke plan, which doesn't mention doing away with them like the Sanders plan does. So that's where the six main candidates stand. Again, you have a range of options for health care. On the far left is Bernie Sanders, which would take a lot of political will to pass, but looks like a really good plan. And even though the main criticism against it is how do we pay for it, Sanders has a plan for that and a lot of different ways that it could be paid for. On the far right,
Warren doesn't have a plan for it.
Warren doesn't yet. No, she may, but she hasn't yet. And on the far right side, we have Joe Biden and even further right, Pete Buttigieg, with little tweaks to the Affordable Care Act, not acknowledging that the Affordable Care Act is in really serious legal trouble right now.
All right. So as you mentioned, there are the debates coming up.
Yeah, the same 20 candidates, with the exception that Representative Eric Swalwell has dropped out of the race and Montana Governor Steve Bullock will take his place. CNN is going to host the debates. They will air live this coming week on CNN, and you can stream them on CNN.com. To qualify for this debate, candidates had to have at least 1% in three qualifying polls and or have received 65,000 unique donations, including at least 200 from 20 different states. Night one on Tuesday, July 30th, it will be Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Pete Buttigieg, Beto O'Rourke. Those are the big four candidates. Also, Amy Klobuchar, John Hickenlooper, Tim Ryan, John Delaney, Marianne Williamson, and Steve Bullock. Night two, that's Wednesday, July 31st, we'll have two big candidates, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. It'll also have Cory Booker, Andrew Yang, Julian Castro, Tulsi Gabbard, Kirsten Gillibrand, Jay Inslee, Michael Bennett, and Bill de Blasio. The candidates that didn't make the cutoff for the debates included Seth Moulton of Massachusetts, Mayor Wayne Messam of Florida, former Senator Mike Gravel, former Congressman Joe Sestak, and rich guy Tom Steyer, who just jumped into the race. Again, candidates will have only 60 seconds to answer questions and only 30 seconds for rebuttal. So, of course, these debates are going to favor candidates who are charismatic and can speak in quick sound bites. They don't necessarily favor candidates with the best policies. So do your homework.
Yeah. And unlike the last debate, the interesting matchups are spread among the two nights.
They are.
Whereas it was really stacked into the second night, which is a much more interesting debate last time. But
I noticed Biden and Harris are in the same night again.
And standing next to each other.
So, yes. Yeah. CNN has said that they won't ask the candidates any yes, no, raise your hand questions like the last debate. But they will penalize any candidate that frequently interrupts others, although I'm not sure how they're going to do that. And we'll see if Bill de Blasio can follow whatever rules they put in place.
Yeah. Or Kirsten Gillibrand.
Yeah.
That a lot of too.
Now, after the July debates, there'll be a break in August. And then the next debates will be held on September 12th and 13th in Houston, Texas, hosted by ABC and Univision. And as Jav said, the qualifying for those debates in September are going to be a lot harder. Candidates are going to have at least 2% in the polls, and they're going to have at least 130,000 unique donations, including at least 400 from 40 different states.
Yeah, just leaves us time for events.
Okay. So I just want to remind people, ballots have been mailed and you should vote and mail your ballot this week. If you haven't received your ballot, you should call King County Elections at 206-296-8683. Tomorrow, Sunday, July 28th, is Unite Against the Right counter protest against a right-wing rally of Proud Boys, Patriots of Washington, and other far-right groups planned for 4 p.m. at Cal Anderson Park on Capitol Hill. Show up in large numbers to protect activists and the LGBTQ community from right-wing violence. Show up at 3:30. It goes from 3:30 to 7 p.m. at Cal Anderson Park, just off Broadway on Capitol Hill. On Monday is Take Action for a Green New Deal. Meet in the lobby of the federal building at the southwest corner of Madison Street and 2nd Avenue downtown. This is hosted by the Sunrise Movement Washington. That's from Monday, 11 a.m. to 12 noon. Also on Monday is Peace Fleet. That's the nonviolent waterfront protest against the glorification of weapons of war at Seafair. That's hosted by Ground Zero Center. Meet at 1 p.m. on the rooftop plaza on Pier 66. There's an elevator inside the Pier 66 Bell Street Cruise Terminal at 225 Alaskan Way. On Monday evening, Central District Meeting Against Gentrification and Displacement, hosted by City Council Member Shama Sawant. That's from 6 to 8 p.m. at New Hope Baptist Church at 124 21st Avenue, just north of Yesler. And then Tuesday is Seattle for Green New Deal. Join 350 Seattle and other groups in attending a city council meeting from 2 to 3 p.m. to advocate for specific policies to enact a Green New Deal for Seattle at Seattle City Hall, 604th Avenue at James Street on the second floor.
All right. Is that it?
Yep.
That's it.
That's it. I do want to point out that Sawant has made a Green New Deal a cornerstone of her campaign for re-election.
Which is good. I wish more candidates would do that.
Yep.
All right. So we'll see you both same place, same time next week.
We'll be back.